Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, our annual Juneteenth special. On June 19th, events in several cities in the U.S. marked the anniversary of Juneteenth, the day on June 19th, 1865, that people enslaved in Texas received news of the Emancipation Proclamation, 2.5 years after President Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation became official on January 1st, 1863. Why is Juneteenth still remembered and celebrated today? And what is the state of race relations in the U.S., the state of Black America? Here is a clip of the mother of Philando Castile, whose son was killed by police in Minneapolis, Minnesota. The police officer who killed him was found not guilty on Friday, June 16th. You may recall that Philando's murder was caught on video by his girlfriend who was sitting next to him in the car. There was also a young child in the car at the time that the officer shot Philando. Let's go to a clip now to hear a response from Philando's mother.
My son loved this city, and this city killed my son, and the murderer gets away. Are you kidding me right now? We're not evolving as a civilization. We're devolving. We have taken steps forward. People have died for us to have these rights, and now we're devolving. We're going back down to 1969. Damn! What is it gonna take? I'm mad as hell right now. Yes, I am. My firstborn one son died here in Minnesota. Under the circumstances, just because he was a police officer, that makes it okay. Oh, now they got free reign. He's found innocent on all counts. He shot into a car with no regard to human life, and that's okay. Thank you, Minnesota. Thank you, Minnesota. That's all I have to say.
And that is part of the context as we mark Juneteenth. Other challenges on race relations include the killing of Charlena Lyles, a 30-year-old Black mother of four, in front of her children this past Sunday, June 18th, in Seattle, Washington, and also the killing of a 17-year-old Muslim girl, Nabra Hassanan, as she left a mosque in Sterling, Virginia, also on Sunday, June 18th. Also, voter suppression continues to be an issue across the U.S., and gerrymandering reaches the U.S. Supreme Court. How are people resisting? Our guests include attorney and voting rights advocate Barbara Arnwine from Black Lives Matter Minneapolis-based Oluchi Omioga and L.A.-based Dr. Melina Abdullah. Also, Trudy Goodwin from Justice Warriors for Black Lives. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandary. The polls are open in Georgia for the most expensive House race in U.S. history. More than $50 million have been spent on a race that's seen as a referendum on Donald Trump's presidency. Either Republican Karen Handel will claim a seat that's been in her party's hands since 1979, or Democrat John Ossoff will manage an upset that will rattle Republicans ahead of the 2018 midterm elections. A political action committee produced a last-minute ad tying Ossoff to the gun attack on congressional Republicans at a baseball practice that has left Louisiana Congressman Steve Scalise in critical condition.
Now the unhinged left is endorsing and applauding shooting Republicans. When will it stop? It won't if John Ossoff wins on Tuesday.
Ossoff and Handel both denounced the ad. Donald Trump has been tweeting on the race this morning, saying Handel will fight for lower taxes, great health care, and strong security. Democratic senators staged a talkathon to dramatize their opposition to Republican efforts to rush through a health bill that's being drafted in secret with no committee hearings. California Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein said she's never seen anything like this process.
I've just got to say, this is the least transparent process for a major piece of legislation I have seen in my 24 years in the Senate. Former Senate historian Don Ritchie said that you have to look back before World War I to find another example of such a secret partisan process for passing a major bill.
Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is aiming for a vote before the July 4th recess. Democrats say leaks indicate the Senate Republican draft is 80% the same as the House bill, which Donald Trump celebrated at the White House when it passed, but recently described as mean. Under special rules, each party will have just 10 hours of debate on the measure before the Senate begins a series of quick amendment votes with little discussion. Newark, New Jersey is the nation's latest sanctuary city. Mayor Ross Baraka signed a 10-page executive order barring the city's police or other agencies from using local resources to cooperate with federal immigration authorities unless there's a court order or directive. Baraka said municipal agencies will not function as immigrant slave catchers. In California, sanctuary state legislation has picked up the support of the state's largest police department. L.A. Police Chief Charlie Beck endorsed SB 54. Beck said the measure would promote the ability of law enforcement to work in immigrant communities.
The ability to get witnesses to come forward, the ability to get victims to come forward, the ability for neighborhoods to thrive because they believe in law enforcement and believe in each other can be severely detrimented by civil enforcement of immigration by local authorities. This is very important. This is not a soft on crime bill. This is not an anti-law enforcement bill.
While the LA police chief endorses the bill, the Los Angeles sheriff opposes it. The California State Senate approved the measure earlier this spring. It's now making its way through the California Assembly. Australia has suspended its airstrikes against Islamic State group targets in Syria as part of the U.S.-led coalition. Australian officials said it's a precaution after a U.S. fighter jet shot down a Syrian warplane earlier this week, and Russia warned the U.S.-led coalition against flying over Syrian army positions west of the Euphrates River. Energy Secretary Rick Perry says he doesn't think carbon dioxide is a primary contributor to global warming. Perry appeared on CNBC.
Most likely the primary control knob is the ocean waters and the this environment that we live in. I mean, the fact is, this isn't a shouldn't be a debate about, you know, is the climate changing? Is man having an effect on it? Yeah, we are. The question should be, you know, just how much and what are the policy changes that we need to make to affect that? I mean, there's just this science, this idea that science is just absolutely settled. And if you don't believe it's settled, then you're somehow or another Neanderthal. That is so inappropriate.
Perry's view is contrary to mainstream climate science, including analyses by NASA and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. But Perry's declaration is in line with other actions by the Trump administration, most notably Donald Trump's withdrawal from the Paris Climate Accord. The EPA recently removed a web page that declared carbon dioxide is the primary greenhouse gas contributing to recent climate change. A new study says killer heat is getting worse. A comprehensive examination of more than 1,900 deadly heat waves says hot spells like the one now broiling the West are bigger killers than previously thought and will be more frequent. I'm Eileen Alfandary. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Juneteenth marks the beginning of emancipation for about 250,000 people enslaved residing in Texas in 1865. People enslaved in Texas learned of their emancipation on June 19, 1865, more than 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation declared by President Lincoln. That took place on January 1, 1863. The 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution was added after Abraham Lincoln's assassination in 1865, which abolished all slavery in the U.S. Confederate soldiers and sympathizers maintained a strong presence in Texas and throughout the South, maintaining the practice of slavery even after the passing of the Emancipation Proclamation. Juneteenth has been a day of remembrance and celebration for African Americans, a de facto second Independence Day commemorating the end of slavery and a first step toward the inclusion in the greater American dream, or, well, the so-named greater American dream. And that is the way it has been described. But as we said in the intro, a lot of challenges are remaining. And for prisoners in the United States, the 13th Amendment does not apply to them. Let us go now to hear from Shanette Garrett Scott, an African-American historian, giving us some of the background of Juneteenth. That's Dr. Shanette Garrett Scott.
Before I talk about that that moment in 1864, let me just give you a very brief background about Emancipation Day celebrations. So African Americans really began celebrating what they would call Emancipation Day during the American Revolution. So they did this because they were commemorating the Declaration of Independence and also this promise of liberty for enslaved African Americans in the new United States. But we know that the founding generation really struggled to try to reconcile this rhetoric about freedom with the reality of slavery. But we do know that there were many northern states, most of the northern states did abolish slavery. And so that tens of thousands of African Americans for generations celebrated Emancipation Day, usually on the 1st of January, but they also sometimes combined them with celebrations on the 4th of July. But Juneteenth is something altogether different and very special. I mean, the fact that it still survives and that it's grown from this Texas tradition to being a celebration commemorated throughout the United States and throughout the world in places like Canada, Nigeria, Japan, France, South Korea, shows that there is something really unique and something really special about Juneteenth. It speaks to us about the past, but it also speaks to us about where we are today. So the title of this speech, of this talk, comes from this quote. "When peace come, they read the Emancipation Law to the colored people. They, the freed slaves, spent that night singing and shouting. They wasn't slaves no more." That's former slave Pierce Harper talking in 1937 recalling what happened in 1865 when the slaves in Texas learned that they had been freed, emancipated 2.5 years earlier by Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation. So certainly the singing and the shouting and the celebrating of those slaves happened quite late. So in spite of Robert E. Lee surrender in April of 1865 at the Appomattox Courthouse, the end of the Civil War did not immediately come to Texas. I mean, it was June 2nd, 1865, before the Confederate General Edmund Kirby Smith finally surrendered to Union forces in Galveston. So slaveholders in Texas really refused to acknowledge that the war was over, and they refused to give up their slaves. Now, holding on to such a fantasy, I know you're probably thinking, how could they continue to do this? But it really wasn't as hard as you would think. That's because Texas was really kind of insulated during the Civil War because of the Confederate blockade. There weren't that many battles that happened in Texas. So the Texas was really shielded from the brunt of the Civil War. In fact, slaveholders, especially those in Mississippi and Louisiana, would bring their slaves to Texas to hide them from the oncoming Union lines. So at the end of the Civil War, there were untold, you know, thousands and maybe tens of thousands of slaves that were added to the 180,000 slaves that were already living here in Texas. So Union Brigadier General Gordon Granger arrived with about 1,800 Union troops at Galveston in mid-July. Don't really know the exact date. But on June 19th, Granger made news of freedom official. He stepped onto the balcony of Ashton Villa, which was the former headquarters of the Army of the Confederate States of America, and he read General Orders Number 3. And this order informed the slaves that the war was over and that they had been freed by Lincoln with the Emancipation Proclamation 2.5 years earlier.
Alrighty, and that was historian Dr. Shanette Garrett Scott on giving us some of the history of Juneteenth. And before we welcome our first guest, I also would like to say we here on Sojourner Truth would like to offer a heartfelt sympathy for all of those who have lost loved ones in the Glenfield Tower fire in London, England, where people were basically burned alive. As of now, the 79 victims, the majority of them people of color, indeed the majority of them of Muslim descent, several of them coming from Syria and other places fleeing war zones. And basically that fire happened because the developers and the Tory government wanted to save £6,000, a little under £6,000 in refurbishing that tower, and did not use fire-resistant material. And also, we would like to offer our sympathy to those, the 10 people and their loved ones who were injured, and the man who died as a result of an attack of Muslims outside a mosque in the Finsbury part of London, England. And so there we go. That's part of the discussion, not only about race relations in the U.S., but also in the U.K. I'd also like to thank all of you for sending your good wishes during my time of being ill away from the station. As you could hear from my voice, I'm still not entirely well, but wanted to be in studio today for our Juneteenth special. I would now like to welcome to Sojourner Truth Patricia Vickers, who's with the Human Rights Coalition. She is the mother of a son who is a lifer, meaning in prison for life, in Greaterford Prison in Pennsylvania. Patricia, welcome.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for having me.
Patricia, you were one of the organizers of a Juneteenth event in Philadelphia over the weekend. Tell us why and the focus, the connections you were making with Juneteenth and the situation your son is in.
Yes, we organized a Juneteenth parade, a celebration for the end of slavery, which would happened in Texas 2.5 years late. And we also wanted to use that time to make the public and people aware that modern-day slavery still does exist. in the prison system in the form of mass incarceration. So that was our idea. It was a beautiful parade. It was a beautiful parade, and a lot of people joined, and it was basically a celebration. We had stopped the parade in front of the Eastern State Penitentiary here in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and the symbolization of that was because in the Eastern State Penitentiary is where they began solitary confinement, where they placed the prisoners in a cell the size of your bathroom with no windows and no other human contact other than the guards, who they were at the guards' mercy to bring them food and water and let them out to get some fresh air 1 hour a day. And that type of abuse still happens today. The Eastern State Penitentiary started that process, and they also ended that process because they found out that it was damaging to the person psychologically. A lot of men went insane. It was abolished and it ended. And some way it was brought back now. And we have so many prisons across the United States where solitary confinement is just like the natural course. The guards come in and they have a bad day or a bad night, and the prisoner looks at them the wrong way or don't obey as quickly, that slave mentality, or question what they say, that slave mentality, they're thrown into solitary confinement.
Yeah, and Patricia, of course, the connection with solitary confinement, mass incarceration, and Juneteenth is the 13th Amendment, because the 13th right. Amendment in the emancipation of people who were enslaved does not include, still to this day, people right. who are incarcerated. So fundamentally, they are treated as people who are enslaved.
And the mentality of the public is that it's okay. You know, it's okay. I don't know how people have become so inhumane. Prisoners are human beings, too. I'm a member and organizer of the Human Rights Coalition, and we fight for the human rights of prisoners. We try to remind people that prisoners are human beings. They're not slaves. They're not animals. That's exactly what we're trying to do here.
Right. And Patricia, for people who want to, thank you for taking a bit time there from your busy schedule to be with us, for the Human Rights Coalition, is there a website or a phone number or some way that people could find out about the work of the Human Rights Coalition? And of course, you had a big success with the victory of Larry Krasner, who's running for district
yes.
attorney in Philadelphia. And he is, you know, fought against police abuse and for prisoners' rights, including Tyree Carroll and Mamiya and the Dallas Six and many others. But for people who want to know about the Human Rights Coalition, what should they do?
We have a website. It's www.hrcoalition.org.
Okay.
We have a email address, info@hrcoalition.org.
Okay, Patricia, on that note, we are going to have to leave it there, but thank you so very much for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
All righty. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. It is our Juneteenth special, and we started out focusing on people where the 13th Amendment, the emancipation of people enslaved, does not apply, and that is to prisoners. I would now like to welcome Barbara Arnwine, veteran civil rights and human rights leader and advocate, currently the executive director of the Transformative Justice Coalition. For several decades, she was the executive director of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights. And of course, she is nationally and internationally known for her work on the 1991 Civil Rights Act and on voting rights and so much more. She's an award-winning advocate. Barbara Arnwine, welcome back.
Well, thank you so much for having me on the show, and thanks for covering this important subject of Juneteenth.
Yeah, and Barbara Arnwine, even as June 19th marked Juneteenth, we have to really pause and look at where we are, because with all of the focus happening in Washington, D.C. on Trump and, you know, Russia and all of that, what is falling under the radar are things happening around voter suppression. We see, though, that there is the Supreme Court will be considering a case having to do with gerrymandering. But just give us your, you know, your views as we mark Juneteenth in terms of where you think we are, in terms of voting rights and anything else that you might want to underscore, Barbara.
Well, we have to remember that during the Civil War, of course, you know, a great percentage, 30% of all dead in the Civil War on the Union side were African Americans. The only, you know, to this day, the only ever led woman raid or military mission was by Harriet Tubman, you know, a black woman during that war. And it's important for us to know that, you know, among many things that our ancestors really fought for, besides, you know, all of their social rights, all of their, you know, economic rights, because they, you know, people forget one of the most understudied parts of that history is the economic power that African Americans asserted, all the economic boycotts they led, all the economic, you know, coalitions that they led, all the alliances that they led. But what people also don't know is that the hardest fought right was for the right to vote. And the right to vote actually was given to, was, let's say, it was secured mostly because of those black Union soldiers, because that was their number one demand. And Congress had no intention of giving the right to vote. In fact, it was the hardest fought issue within the, quote, radical Reconstruction Congress. And that is the last of the Civil War amendments speaks to that problem, that they did not know how to secure the vote because they didn't want to do it. And it was black Union soldiers who demanded that. And because after the war, all the white soldiers had a home to go to and the black soldiers did not, having, you know, previously served on plantations that no longer existed or that they certainly aren't going back to, they were the majority of the Union Army during the time of the Reconstruction Congress. So it is very significant that when the first, you know, acts of readmission for the Southern states were passed, that they made the Southern states agree that the franchise would have to be part of that. So blacks were voting, that is, black men were voting prior to the passage of the 15th Amendment because of the readmission standards and conditions that were posed on the states. So it's very, very important to know that this fight for voting rights has always been hard. And what we're seeing right now is the continuation of that fight by the Southern states, in particular against providing those voting rights. But we've also seen this problem in the Midwest, in the, you know, in the East, in the North, in the New England area. We've seen it on the West Coast. We're seeing this whole new movement that's called, you know, let's restrict the voting franchise. Let's make it as small as possible. Let's make it as favorable to you know, one party of, you know, very conservative people as possible. And in order to do that, we're going to use voter suppression. So what we've seen is a new wave of voter suppression. Even today, in 2017, over 30 states have pending about 85 to 90 voter suppression measures. Some of these have already passed. And it's very tragic, and it's very important that people realize that we have to fight, you know, voter suppression, that we have to make sure that people register, but more important, that they vote, and that people really understand that this fight is ongoing, that it has historical roots, but it also has present-day realities.
Barbara Arnwine, I mean, you, thank you for that. You outlined that history really very well. A lot of people also today unaware of the 30 states and voter suppression, and that it did have an impact in the last election. And also part of what is happening, too, is this whole gerrymandering business. The Supreme Court, now they're going to hear a case on gerrymandering and a case in Wisconsin. Tell us about that. What is the relationship between that and voter suppression? Although we know that both of the main parties, the Republicans and the Democrats, use gerrymandering or the drawing up of, you know, voting areas on the election map. But do you see a connection between how gerrymandering has been used and voter suppression, Barbara Arnwine?
Well, it's fascinating. The court last month in May actually decided two major racial gerrymandering cases.
Mm-hmm.
Racial gerrymandering is where you actually draw districts purposefully to either advance or to harm African-American political or other racial minority political participation. Political influence is really what they're trying to do, is to make sure that blacks can't, you know, influence a lot of elections, or Native Americans or Latinos or Asians can't influence, you know, all the elections. So they pack people or they crack people, right? Pack means you put everybody black in one area so that that's the only area they can influence, and you pack them. The cracking is where you take blacks who could, you know, have political power, or Latinos who could have political power, and you just scatter them all over districts where they can't have any influence. So basically last May, this past May, the Supreme Court found that North Carolina had engaged in a series of packing plans where they had packed African-Americans into districts, both congressional and in the second case in the areas of state assembly slots, representatives and Senate slots. Now, what's very, very important, everyone, to know is that the current case that they're about to hear is very different, because this case involves political gerrymandering. Now, political gerrymandering is where you say, okay, well, we are the dominant party, we're the dominant Republican Party in this state, and we're going to draw all the districts to make sure that Republicans have as much influence forever and ever as we can in this redrawing. So we're going to put as many Republicans into the districts. We're going to draw them where, if there are Democrats, we're going to, you know, crack those districts and make sure that they can't consolidate to have, you know, political power. We're going to make sure that that this is going to be, you know, our dominant, power base. And what the court has said in the past is that, well, you know, that's allowable, but it's questionable. Now, the fact that they're taking up this case comes out of the defenses that the states keep making in racial gerrymandering cases, saying, well, we're doing this because of politics, not race. And the court has been saying, well, wait a minute, even if it were political, this looks suspect, that you're denying people the ability to elect candidates of their choice, that you're going too far and too extensively excessively in your political drawing. And that is precisely what the Wisconsin lower court found, was that the drawing of these districts had been done purposefully and deliberately and excessively to block political power by the opposition party. So that is what we're dealing with. So this is going to be interesting, because the court has never really done anything strong to restrain political gerrymandering, and in fact has, you know, excused it over and over and over again, and allowed people to really use it as a camouflage for racial gerrymandering, etc. So this is going to be a very important case. Now, a lot of people are saying, with Gorsuch on the case court, given the tendencies of the sitting members of the court, that they don't see how this case is going to be decided in a positive manner. In fact, a lot of people are worried that it may be used to undermine some of the cases that have been focused on racial gerrymandering, that it might bleed into that area also. So this is going to be an important, very important case. Don't forget, everyone, the census is coming up, the 2020 census, and redistricting will follow in every single state in our nation.
Right, and thank you for that. We're going to have to wrap it up here, Barbara Arnwine, but we'll have you back. And Barbara, I just want to underscore that if voting was not important, you could see from the time of emancipation that there have been efforts put in place to block Black folks from voting, right? So
well, you know,
there's got to be a reason for that.
Well, yeah. Takes me out, Margaret, that people say, oh, voting doesn't count. Well, if it doesn't count, then why are people spending billions upon millions of dollars to deny your vote?
That's
in
right.
In fact, in Georgia today, all my Georgians, listen, you got to vote. In Georgia today until 7 p.m. while the polls are open in the Georgia Congressional 6th District, they're actually running ads where they have, you know, pieced together, you know, Obama's voice. To try to argue that Blacks shouldn't vote, saying, you know, trying to discourage Black people from voting by saying, oh, you know, the Democrats take me for granted, blah, 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 and you don't want to vote. And so they're doing every kind of dirty trick they can to win. And they're spending millions of dollars
yeah.
to do this, people. So if your vote didn't count, then why is it so expensively being denied to you?
Right. Well, I'm really glad you raised that, because the Sojourner Truth listeners, so I'm from WRFG in the greater Atlanta area. They are going to be going out to vote today. So thank you. Thank you for that, Barbara Arnwine. Appreciate you.
Thank you so much, Margaret. This show is magnificent. We're always sojourning. Thank you.
All righty. We are going to take a short station break. And coming up, key folks from Black Lives Matter. And Trudy Goodwin, also from Warriors for Black Lives. Stay with us for our Juneteenth special. We'll be right back.
Let my people go!
Now when Israel was in Egypt land,
let my people go.
Oppressed so hard they could not stand.
Let my people go.
So the Lord said, go down.
Go down.
All righty, the great Louis Armstrong, Go Down, Moses. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We'd like to welcome our SoundCloud listeners. Look for us on SoundCloud. Just look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. And today we would like to give a shout out on, and this our Juneteenth special, to our SoundCloud listeners in the great state of Texas. And you can also check us out on our website at www.sotrueradio.org. And if you're a member of Facebook, like and friend us on Facebook. Spread the word. We are continuing our annual Juneteenth special, Juneteenth, June 19th, all righty, Juneteenth, the day that people enslaved in Texas received news of the Emancipation Proclamation 2.5 years after President Abraham Lincoln's proclamation became official January 1st, 1863. We're going to continue now with our Black Lives Matter guests coming up, but first, our weekly Earth Minute is back.
Wildfires in Portugal continue to rage after killing more than 60 people in what the government there called the worst such disaster in recent history. Many died in their cars trying to escape the flames. These were not, however, fires in natural forests, but fires in non-native eucalyptus plantations. Portugal's disastrous fires bear striking similarity to fires that raged through Chile's Biobío region in January, killing 11. These too were the result of widespread plantations of highly flammable eucalyptus trees. In both countries, dry conditions contributed to the fires. Eucalyptus plantations are well known for water depletion and worsening droughts. Now the USDA wants to allow the development of genetically engineered eucalyptus plantations across the drought-stricken southeast U.S. Let's learn from the experiences of Chile and Portugal and not allow the carnage and destruction that accompany vast plantations of these living firecrackers. Sign on to Stop GE Eucalyptus Plantations. Visit stopgetrees.org/actionalert. For the Earth Minute and the Sojourner Truth Show, this is Ann Peterman from Global Justice Ecology Project.
I am delighted to welcome to Sojourner Truth, welcome back, Dr. Melina Abdullah, who is with Black Lives LA, and she's professor and chair of the Pan-African Studies Department at Cal State University, Los Angeles. Melina, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Sister Margaret, and congratulations on your Freedom Now Award that you'll be receiving on Saturday from LA Can.
Oh, thank you so much. And for people who want to come and celebrate with me on our website on calendar, you will have information from the Freedom Now Awards. I'm honored to be receiving this coming Saturday. I'd also like to welcome, so thank you for that, Melina. I'd also like to welcome Oluchi Amyoga, who is with Black Lives Matter in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Oluchi, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
All righty. What we're going to do before we start this discussion with both of you is that we're going to hear a short clip from Black Lives Matter New York. And this is protesting, of course, the not guilty verdict in the Philando Castile case, and reminding our listeners that on Friday, June 16th, Minnesota police officer Yanez was cleared of manslaughter charges in the shooting death of Philando Castile that took place last summer. Castile is a 32-year-old cafeteria supervisor at an elementary school. On July 6, 2016, he was driving through Falcon Heights when he was pulled over by the police. Castile alerted the police that there was a gun in the car. He was a legal gun owner. He was asked for his license. He was reaching for his license and he was shot by Yanez. His girlfriend, Diamond Reynolds, was also in the car with her 4-year-old daughter. She caught it on video. And in fact, she was reminding the officer that he had a weapon, don't shoot, that he was, you know, reaching for the information the officer had requested. Moments after Castile was shot, she captured the events with her phone and live streamed it on Facebook. Despite the video evidence, Yanez was found not guilty by the jury. After the verdict, thousands of protesters flooded the streets of St. Paul, marching outside the Minnesota State Capitol building, while also protesting on Interstate 94. According to the Minnesota State Patrol, 18 people were arrested at the protest. But protests happen in other cities as well. Let's hear a short clip now from Black Lives Matter New York. And this is from an interview with from the Young Turks.
Of course, we raise awareness through marches, but also you have to be proactive after the marches, like speaking with politicians, just anybody in the government. So we just have to keep resisting, you know, never back down, you know, because that's what they want us to do. And to any Black people that see this right here, what I want to say to you guys, and just anybody in general, if you are neutral during the times of oppression, you automatically choose the side of the oppressor. You do. Especially for my Black people, you cannot be neutral. There's no such thing as being neutral for us, because being neutral, that doesn't save us. You know, our lives are still in grave danger every single day. So please wake up, stay, keep fighting. Black Lives Matter.
All righty. Stay woke. And that, Oluchi Amyoga, let us start with you. You are right in the heart of the matter there in Minnesota. So tell us your response and the response of Black Lives Matter in your city to this horror of this police officer.
So my personal response is going to be a little different than a lot of people in Minneapolis because where Philando was actually shot, my dad works like two blocks away. And as a black man, it was hard for me to, like, be in this case because it was in such close proximity to where my father works. And, like, that literally could have been my father. So this, the, like, this whole Philando case was a very, very triggering and traumatic case for me. And I know it was for the family as well. It's hard because we also lost Jamar Clark in the winter of 2015. So there's been a lot of trauma in the Twin Cities. And I know that a lot of people are feeling numb and a lot of people are feeling like there's not really an outlet. But then there's a lot of other different organizations that are coming together that are doing actions on the daily to make sure that this is not someone that's just forgotten. So there is a lot of action that's happening in the Twin Cities, and a lot of people are angry, and a lot of people are starting to understand, like, how these systems are against us, and specifically a lot of white people, because the Twin Cities is coined as, like, one of the greatest cities in America. It's, like, coined as, like, there's a lot of business, and then there's a lot of jobs, but it's actually one of the worst cities in the United States for black people. And we're finally seeing that now in how this case was handled and how he was found not guilty on all counts, like not even child endangerment, not even any of this. So a lot of people are being angry and are continuing to be angry, which is good.
Right. And Melina Abdullah, you know, getting your response as well. I mean, adding insult to injury, you know, we also have the case that just happened over this weekend of Charlena Lyles, a pregnant mother of four living in Seattle, who was shot and killed by the police with her children present. She had called the police to report an attempted burglary in her home. And the police said she displayed a knife and two officers shot at her. And now you're hearing a lot about the fact that she had mental issues. But what does that have to do with two police officers shooting to death a short, small black woman with children in the house?
Right, and we absolutely have to pay attention to what's happening with Charlena Lyles and watch this process of them attempting to discredit the people that they kill. They did the same thing with Philando Castile. We need to think about what happened. One of the most jarring things out of both of these cases is recognizing the role that police play and that these outcomes are not accidental. So with Philando Castile, we need to remember he was pulled over 52 times for minor traffic stops prior to his murder. With Charlena Lyles, the police had come and accused her of things like harassment prior to her killing. So we need to think about not just reforming police, not just police as bad apples, not just looking at Yanez as, you know, someone who was overreacting, but look at the overall institution of policing and recognize that they were created for the purposes of these outcomes. And I know that's a hard thing for some people to accept, but we have to really look at how do we invest in the things that actually make communities safe rather than spending on police who harass, brutalize, and kill our people. And so we have to start moving away from those things. Had Charlena Lyles called a friend or a neighbor or a family member rather than police, although she's conditioned, we're all conditioned to look to police for help, you know, had she called and had an alternative, she'd likely still be alive. Had, you know, the police not been empowered to pull over, let's also talk about the absolute institutional racism that played out in the stopping of Philando Castile and his girlfriend and the baby girl in the back seat, right? The audio tape where They're saying, well, I'm pulling him over because he has a wide-set nose. That is racial profiling if nothing else is, right? So we have to pull back from the systems that are keeping us oppressed and killing our people and invest in other systems, invest in alternatives.
Right. And Dr. Malina Abdullah and Oluchi Amyogo, what we're going to do, I mean, this is our Juneteenth special. We do have another guest coming up about another horror happening in Southern California, students being under threat for protesting racism. I'd really like to do a full hour roundtable just on the Black Lives Matter groups, the work that you're doing, putting that together with the Movement for Black Lives, and really just have an in-depth discussion about all of this. And I'm hoping that both of you would be open to being part of that discussion. Would that be okay with you?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Can I just say one last quick thing? We also want to lift up Sister Nabra Hassanin, who was killed in Sterling.
That's right.
Virginia, black Muslim girl, 17 years old. This is a moment where we have to, reinvest in our own power. And we have to stand up. We have to fight harder. It's not a time to go home.
Yeah, absolutely. And we did mention her in our intro. And also we're remembering the Muslims in London, England, who were attacked so brutally over the weekend. We appreciate you, Oluchi Amyogo and Malina Abdullah. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All righty. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and we're wrapping our show up now. We'd like to welcome Trudy Goodwin, a writer, social justice activist, and co-founder of the Committee for Racial Justice in Santa Monica, where she works to dismantle mass incarceration, racial oppression, and gentrification. She is an original member of the Black Panther Party of Los Angeles and is a current member of Justice Warriors for Black Lives and the Los Angeles Community Action Network. She is a MFA fellow of creative writing at Mount St. Mary's University, Los Angeles, and she was a retired cultural arts producer. Trudy, welcome.
Thank you so much, Margaret.
Okay, so Trudy, tell us about this case. I'm looking at a press release here. I'd like to give a shout out to my colleague, Nana Jumphy, for alerting me to this situation out at Claremont McKenna. Trudy, what's going on?
Absolutely. On April 6th of this year, students participated in a peaceful protest at Claremont McKenna. And what they were protesting was a feature speaker, Heather McDonald, who was brought to the school by the very right-wing think tank, the Rose Institute. She herself comes from the very right-wing Manhattan Institute. And her recent work includes a talk on the war on police, which supports and justifies the hyper-criminalization and extrajudication of killing of black and brown people. And what the students were doing was protecting their communities from her hate speech and her violent rhetoric. And so some of the people that were there to hear her were not allowed to enter the venue. And the protesters were never given a dispersal order, Margaret, nor warned that their failure to disperse might lead to disciplinary action. And so of the 250 protesters from all of Claremont's 7 colleges, only 7 to 10 Claremont McKenna College students are being investigated for alleged conduct violations.
Yeah, and I understand, too, that there's been a death threat received in connection with the protest. Trudy?
Several.
Mm.
As a matter of fact, the students have not wanted to go on film or have their names in the media because they have received death threats, multiple death threats, from various members of the they believe the Claremont McKenna community and other right-wing nut jobs that don't believe that if you're protesting against something that's racist, that you should have the freedom to do that. So, and this is a nationwide, we're seeing this nationwide where protests are being either put down by police officials or, you know, government officials or these folks that are just in our communities that are just not well, not balanced, and not understanding that this is a First Amendment right to gather and protest. So we're seeing this more and more, Margaret, where folks are being denied that right. Right now, the fate of these students depend upon how the CMC's dean of student and his faculty vote.
Yeah.
How they receive this information from an investigator who honestly went before this panel and gave her opinion of how the students were out of policy and and should be, you know, and should be disciplined. Where, you know, in actuality, what police officer do you know goes into a court and then says those people should be found guilty? The only thing that the police can do is give witness to what they saw or what was done. And this person actually gave her opinion that these people were out of policy and should be punished.
Well, let me ask you this, Trudy Goodwin, because we are out of time. For people who want to find out about the work of Justice Warriors for Black Lives that are involved in this case, what should they do?
Go to the Justice Warriors for Black People Facebook page because the information about this trial and the other work that we're doing is there.
Right.
But Margaret, we're also asking people to contact the Claremont McKenna College administration, the president and the dean of faculty, and let them know how disgusting this punitive attack on these students are.
Well, thank you for that, Trudy. And between you and Nan, I'm sure we'll continue to keep us posted as this continues. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
All righty. We are out of time. I'd like to thank all of today's guests and today's show produced by Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the entire Sojourner Truth team, our assistant producer, Stephanie Case, our intern, Sherelle Withers, and Mr. T, Teddy Robinson. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Sojourner Truth. We'll be back on the air tomorrow. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.